Today on the Best of Flashpoints, we'll continue our coverage on the Free Gaza Movement Freedom Flotilla, which was attacked by Israeli commandos on Monday, May 31st. We'll speak with Paul Arudi and Fatima Mohammadi, who were on board vessels in the flotilla, as well as Max Blumenthal, who has been doing investigative reporting on the incident from Israel. We'll also continue our focus on the recent border killing of a 14-year-old junior high school student in Juarez, Mexico, by a U.S. Border Patrol agent who shot and killed the young man from across the border. I'm Jesse Strauss with Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on today's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
Fifteen-year-old Sergio Adrian Hernandez was only the latest victim of the Border Patrol at the Texas-Mexico border. The 15-year-old was shot in the head and the eye by Border Patrol agents who claimed that they were just defending themselves against rock-throwing illegal aliens. It turns out that Sergio was shot on the Mexican side of the border. Tonight, angry citizens in El Paso and on the other side of the border in Juarez are holding a vigil to protest the unnecessary killing and the continued militarization at the border. We spoke before airtime to one of the vigil organizers, Mikey Velarde, about the vigil, and he began with this background on the shooting and on the community in which it happened.
Well, locally, this area is well known for migrant crossings. Historically, it's been a place where migrants have more or less freely come across. But early in the 90s, we see a militarization of this area, so we see an enormous jump in the number of Border Patrol agents and their various apparatuses. So this is a very well-known area for migrants and for the Border Patrol. However, a number of folks have died there under various circumstances. Some people have drowned. Some people have been, in the case of Sergio Adrián Hernández Huereca, he was killed, you know, as you described, point blank, by a Border Patrol agent. So it's a very, very interesting and very violent space, as we see the mix of people, but also the sort of state repression that exists there in all its forms.
Now, the Border Patrol says that they were defending themselves against a stone-throwing mob. Witness says the young man, the 15-year-old young Mexican, was actually shot in the head while he was sitting down and wasn't throwing anything. What's your best understanding of what happened?
You know, it's difficult to really pick through the very specific details of the case, but you know, I'd like for us to really think about the inequality of the situation here. I mean, even say this individual could throw a rock, I mean, it's at best 20, 30, 40 feet. I mean, we don't know where these two individuals were. So that, to me, is a very absurd claim that it's some form of self-defense when you have a Border Patrol agent who is supposedly, you know, we're going to presume that they're well-trained in handling weapons and in handling difficult situations like this. And I mean, come on, a 14-year-old boy who gets shot in the eye for supposedly throwing a rock, I mean, it's just incredibly unequal here. So for me, when I hear that, I think it's just, of course, a way of defending the atrocity that took place on Monday. But, you know, this is sort of a commonplace thing that in any area where you have such great inequality, you're going to see some sort of conflict, some sort of tension between the two. And I think that's really embodied in the kind of graffiti that you see actually by where the individual was killed. There's a lot of graffiti on the barrier of the river. You know, there's not much water. You can see, you know, different forms of protest to the border itself.
And what are the kinds of things? What kind of graffiti is on the wall? What do we see? What is the message?
The graffiti is on the sort of river bank. It's a man-made river in that area. It's sort of a canal, and on the banks of the canal, you can see stuff like images of Che Guevara. You also see messages like water for water for the people and not for business, different various messages about George Bush. So it's really, a concise articulation of the injustices that border embodies.
Are these bilingual messages on the graffiti wall?
I think there are some, but the majority is in Spanish.
In Spanish. Tell us a little bit about the mood in the community. After all, this is the second shooting in 2 weeks. This is a 15-year-old. I'm looking at the photograph of Sergio Hernandez, and he was just a young man. He wasn't dressed to do anything but go out and sort of hang around. He was in his sneakers, his shorts, and now he's dead. What's the mood in the community?
I mean, the various sectors of the community have kind of come out in protest of this in various forms. I mean, it's important to remember that this city is situated in a highly militarized area. So
when you say that, what does that mean, highly militarized? Are there checkpoints? Are there helicopters?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I live in a neighborhood that's near the border, and you can hear helicopters flying during the day, at night, the Border Patrol helicopters, of course. You see Border Patrol agents riding around on bicycles in the local university, through the neighborhoods. I mean, different forms of symbolic power that show, you know, who's in charge, and you better not get out of line is basically the message that they're sending. But in addition to this, El Paso is also the location of Fort Bliss, which is a major military installation here.
All right. Well, we wish you the best. We urge you to be careful, and we hope that there isn't another shooting of another 15-year-old or a 16-year-old or a 33-year-old with five kids. We're watching it very closely, and we will be in touch with you. Please be careful.
Thank you so much. Take care.
And this is Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We continue our coverage of the cold-blooded killing of a teenager by Border Patrol in El Paso. Well, actually, he was killed in Mexico, and it appears that a number of laws, besides taking somebody's life, a teenager who happens to be a good student in Juarez, shooting across the border into Mexico is also a crime. Murder's a crime. We're not going to let this one go, so we continue our discussion. We go to El Paso, Texas, where we're joined by Zelene Panita. She is an activist, a human rights activist, been working years, born in El Paso, and helped organize a vigil for this young man, who, by the way, was, surprise, surprise, a good student, soccer player, and was executed, I guess, for what? Being in Mexico, being young. Zelene Panita, remind people what happened. We know that on Monday, about 6:45, typical hot day, it was about 95 degrees. People were coming back and forth between Juarez and El Paso. Could you describe the scene again, as best as you know at this point, what happened and how this young man was shot in the head?
Right. I mean, I think before last night, when Univision got a hold of a cell phone recording of the actual events, there was still a lot of smoke to exactly what happened. There were different accounts. So, of course, of the people that were present, you know, had a very different account from what the FBI or the Border Patrol released. The FBI and the Border Patrol made it seem like it was like this officer was defending his life, like he was being attacked by, you know, these by a big group throwing rocks. But when you see the video, you see a group of kids, about four of them, one including Sergio Adrián Hernández Huereca, trying to cross into the U.S. side of the border, and then you see about two or three Border Patrol agents coming in to riding in their bikes, and then the kids start running back towards Mexico. One of the agents grabs a hold of Sergio Adrián. The kids, you can't see the rocks that supposedly are being thrown in the video. You can't see them, so there aren't really, there's no rocks there. If they are, they're very small because it's all concrete. And then you hear a shot, and you actually hear multiple shots, but one of those shots hit Sergio Adrián, and it's and now we have evidence that it was at very close range, and that in military terminology, what happened was not a good kill, which means that it cannot be justified as the agent defending himself. It was. For whatever reason, maybe the agent was panicked or what have you, he should have been a trained, it brings to light that there's not proper training, there's no proper repercussions or means to hold these agents accountable. Now, we have video of what happened, so there's very little room for them to back out or to manipulate things now,
I've looked at that video now at least a dozen times, and it is very clear that the Border Patrol grabs one kid and pulls his gun at the same time, hops off his bike, pulls his gun, puts it to one kid's face, throws him down, and aims and then fires at the kids across the river on the Mexican side. That's what is pretty clear, isn't it?
Yes.
So what's the mood in the town today? I guess, of course, if you're in Juarez, this is becoming an old sad story, but what's the mood and how does it add on to what's already been going on?
Well, unfortunately, the border is very violent right now. I mean, in El Paso and Juarez, we have a very strange relationship, and we have very strange contrast. For example, Juarez is known for very many years has been known to be a place a very violent place. It's synonymous for the unsolved murders of hundreds of women, and now the cartel wars. It's now been declared the most dangerous city in the world, and then you have El Paso on the other side. It's the second safest city in the United States of its size. So, and then we have Border Patrol agents everywhere. I go to the university here, UTEP, University of Texas at El Paso, and you'll see five Border Patrol in their bikes running around campus. It's a very militarized city, and we also have Fort Bliss, which is a military base. So it's very militarized. And also in Juarez, it's very militarized. They have the Mexican army, and so it's very militarized. And a lot of the abuses and a lot of the deaths and a lot of the violence that happens is in the hands of the Border Patrol, the Mexican military, the sheriffs here that ask people intimidate people by asking them for their immigration status. So it's a very strange place. It's very contradictory, and it's very painful to live here. It's very painful because you see images like that every single day in the newspaper.
If you're brown, you get put down. If you're white, you walk.
Right. I mean, and then here, racism is not Latin American racism is not necessarily based on your color. I mean, of course, if you're a certain color, you're subject to
the racial profiling, which is a part of it.
But a lot of it is also very economic. You know, like it's economic racism. It's if you don't have money or if you have a certain name, you know, that also holds you accountable to, you know, to how you're going to be treated. And it's also a very sexist place. It's a very painful time and place to live in.
And how will people try and call for justice here? We only have a minute left, but okay. Now that we have a videotape, it's sort of like Palestine and catching the Israelis as killers, because we finally have a videotape. So you've got a tape here. You've got a great piece of footage that contradicts both the Border Patrol and the FBI. What do you do next?
Well, I mean, I think The community is asking for a thorough investigation. More than, and I think that's really all we can ask. And it's kind of sad, you know, because we already lost a life, and the Obama has decided to send even more military and more resources into these agencies without really having any provisions for their accountability or for their actions. And this officer is getting a paid administrative leave for killing a 14-year-old. So I think not just on the border, but especially on the border. I mean, it recently happened in San Diego. Here on the border, this is something that we live with every day. We have to question the kind where we have to completely distrust the government. I mean, we distrust the government, and I think unfortunately, but also fortunately, like, it's bringing us together, and we're trying to fight to not let our voices be silenced and be repressed by this extremely militarized state that we live in.
All right, Celine Panita, I know you started a new group to deal with this from the bottom up.
Great, thank you so much.
All right, thank you, and be careful. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we turn to our attention back to the situation in occupied Palestine and a very devoted international group of activists who are trying to break the blockade, the punishing deadly blockade on the Gaza Strip and the people of the Gaza Strip who have suffered injustices in so many different ways. It's incomprehensible, and most people don't understand what's going on there because there is a lock on information, particularly in this country. Breaking open the lock and trying to break that hold on Gaza and break the embargo are a number of groups, a number of individuals. Paul Arruti is from the Bay Area. We're very proud to have you here in the studio, Paul, given the stance that you have taken with the Palestinians who risk a great deal every day and risked sort of the kind of beating you got on a daily basis, and many of them face it on a daily basis. Welcome back, and how are you, Paul?
I'm doing fine, and I'm glad you pointed out that this is something that it's being treated as exceptional because it's an unusual event of a large number of people trying to get into Gaza. But the characteristic of it is exactly what you say, that this is Israel striking out with massive force against an unarmed population, in this case 650 to 700 people trying to get supplies into Gaza. But that's what they always do, isn't it? They always use massive force on a relatively unarmed population. And it just, in this case, it happens to be us. I got beat up, but what am I, number 567,002 or something? I don't know.
Well, it still hurts a lot, and you got beat up more than once. And I want to talk a little bit with you about what happened. Where were you when the commandos came?
We were on the Sfandoni, which is a passenger vessel that had about 43 people on it, which is close to not quite capacity on that vessel. And the commandos came on board and stormed the wheelhouse. We used nonviolent resistance by locking arms and the traditional kinds of ways of doing it. They tasered us and used batons and sound bombs and tear gas, and
they didn't shoot you with paint guns.
They did.
They did that too.
Yeah, I don't know what that's about, but and they broke the window in the wheelhouse and all this sort of thing. And then they handcuffed us with nylon ties, and then they lined us up on the deck there, in the deck chairs, and started to take people off one by one. And I don't know what they were doing, you know.
What were they saying? Were they talking with you as they were handcuffing you, gathering you, putting you together?
All they said was, "You sit here and you come with us." And you know, it was clear right from the beginning that they did not want to provide much information to us, and we were denied, for example, television, radio, newspapers, any reading material, even writing material, denied access to each other. We were separated.
They collected all your recording equipment, cell phones, everything.
Yeah, they said specifically, it's better for you if you turn over any electronic equipment that you have. If we find it and you didn't tell us about it, then we don't promise how it'll be treated. So they were coercing that too.
And then how did you end up on shore? Did they take you on the boat that you were on, or did they take you?
Well, I can't speak very well to that because I ended up getting to shore in a very different way.
How did that happen?
What I saw after the initial encounter was that a lot of the people were just saying, "Well, what can we do now? Let's just live with it." And I wasn't willing to do that. I felt that we could do a lot more in terms of resistance. And we had said before that we were going to do more in terms of resistance by refusing to cooperate. So I felt like we could do more, and what I decided to do was to go over the side. I spoke in Greek, actually. With my Greek is not great, but it's the only language I had that I was sure that the Israelis wouldn't understand.
It's Greek to them.
And so I asked a couple of the Greek people, "What do you think if I go over the side?" And they said, "Well, we like the idea." And so it occurred to me that, first of all, the chances, it's a calculated risk, but that they would not abandon me there. How would they explain, you know, them not picking me up? And the second thing is that if they were willing to abandon me there, what would be the reaction of my fellow passengers? Maybe that would get them to start to do something. So I felt it was worth the risk. So I jumped over the side, and sure enough, the boat stopped. And my guess is that they called it in and were told, "Well, hang around, make sure the guy is picked up by another boat." And they said, "We'll call in another boat to pick him up." And the other ship came over, a Coast Guard cutter, or I don't know what these things are. But anyway, they came over, and we played a game of cat and mouse for a while, and I was able to evade them.
Believe it or not. Swimming in the water?
Yeah. Yeah, and believe it or not, I was able to evade this thing. I mean, it's a more interesting story than we have time for, but
we're going to make time. By the way, we're going to hold the segment. We did an interesting interview with Francis Boyle about international law, but we're going to hold that, folks, until tomorrow, because I want to hear this. Go on.
Okay. Well, in the water, the other boat came and tossed me a life preserver. Right. And I just ignored it. And they said, hey, you stupid idiot, we're here to rescue you. And I didn't say anything. And then they threw a grappling hook, you know, one of those three-prong things, not sharp edges on it. And I realized that if they do that enough, they're going to snag me and pull me in. So I caught it with my hands and let them pull me in part of the way. And then when they got it to a certain distance, I just let it go. So I was controlling it, you know, and making it impossible for them to actually use it. So as they pulled me in close to the ship, they decided, okay, let's just use a hook that's on a long pole. They had that too. And in that case, I could just swim away. So they said, okay, this is a very maneuverable boat. We can actually rotate in a circle. And so they did, but it's a big boat, and I don't care how maneuverable it is. If I stay close to the axis and keep swimming to the reverse and to the right, I can avoid it, and I was able to. So then they said, oh, the hell with this. And they started to get the inflatable Zodiac ready. And that took them about 10 or 15 minutes before they got it in the water. And meanwhile, I was swimming in the opposite direction towards the original boat, the Svendoni. And I was pretty far away by the time they got that thing in the water. And then they discovered, you're going to love this. The motor didn't work.
On their boat, huh?
On the Zodiac. And so they had to throw a line to the Zodiac, tow it over to me. The thing had something wrong with the line, so that the gas wasn't feeding properly, and it run for maybe 10, 15 seconds, and that's it. But once they finally got it close up to me, the 10 or 15 seconds was enough to scoot it along fast enough to catch up with me, and then they caught me. By that time, I want to tell you,
they were angry.
They were angry. And I paid the price. So that's where I got my black eye and a couple of other things, too. They grabbed me, pulled me out of the water, and slammed my head on the floor of it and gave me a couple of punches and whatever.
Peaceful resistance.
Yes, exactly.
You didn't hurt them?
No.
You didn't threaten them?
No.
You didn't try and throw them in the water?
No.
You didn't pull a weapon on them? They just were angry because you didn't want them to undermine the mission.
That's right.
Of trying to break that Gaza blockade and bring needed supplies.
That's right. And what I learned was that every time they wanted compliance over the next 3 days, as they have for the last 62 years, they apply pain and misery in order to get the compliance, which they invariably fail to get. They haven't gotten it out of the Palestinians for 62 years, and they didn't get it out of me. But they'd apply it anyway. If pain doesn't work, apply more pain.
And did they torture you? Did they just beat you outright?
Well, I'll give you an example. They, on the Zodiac, they used nylon ties to tie my hands and legs. And then afterwards, they hoisted me to the ship. And they put ropes underneath my arms, and the ropes slipped because they were also pulling by the ties. I mean, they were lifting me by the ties around my wrists, and you can imagine how it was cutting into my wrists. And when they finally got me on the ship, they put me on the stern of the ship, on this surface that is extremely rough and jagged, in order to allow their combat boots to grip on a ship's surface, which is wet. They sat me down on that for three and a half, 4 hours. And they had the sun baking down on me at the same time that I was freezing, because it was wet and getting spray, and they were going fast enough that the wind was evaporating the spray on me. I said, listen, you guys, I'm going to go into shock if you don't put something warmer on me. And I started to tremble and all this sort of thing. So finally they put some sweatpants on me. But at the time, I was blindfolded as soon as I got on the ship. And my hands and legs were still, tied. And they fastened me to the mast or some kind of upright thing there on the rear of the ship. And they said, what's your name? And I said, I think I didn't respond at all. And they said, you tell us your name and cooperate with us, or else you're going to spend the rest of the trip up here. Otherwise, we can put you downstairs. But they didn't allow me to respond to that even, because I was willing to give up the idea of, say, jumping off the ship another time and things like that. No, there was no point in that anymore. But I wasn't going to tell them my name. But they didn't even allow me to respond. So they kept me there until he came back later, and then I said, you know, I won't cause you any more trouble, but I'm not going to tell you my name. And at that point, he said, okay. So he took me down, and the remainder of it was about an hour and a half, I guess, was below deck.
So that was the end of the beatings?
That was the end of the beatings then. There was a lot more to come.
There were more beatings. I know that,
yeah,
Paul.
Yeah.
And they tried to interrogate you?
Yes.
And they also used force in that context?
Yeah, and the result of that was that they tore the pants that they had given me so that my crotch was showing, you know. And I said, you know, this is unacceptable. You have to get me another pair of pants, a decent pair of pants. And apparently I asked too many times, and so they decided to teach me a lesson for asking me so many times. So they got about 10 or 12 guys together, carried me over to one section of the processing center, and beat me hard. I mean, they slammed my head against the floor, and they kicked me in the head, and they kicked me in the ribs, and you know, I mean, you can imagine. And so when they were finished, they said, do you still want pants? I said, yes, I still want my pants. And I said it as loud as I could. There was media around. So I said, go ahead, break my arms, break my head, do whatever you want, but get me my pants.
I understand there is another boat somewhere getting ready or on the way. Is that true?
Yes, I mean, you've heard the same things I have. I can't verify what's actually happening.
Or where it is, yeah, at this given,
exactly,
moment.
Right.
Or where the one is that's coming after it,
right,
and the one that's coming after that one.
Exactly.
But they're apparently lined up somewhere.
Apparently so, and I guess I'll find out more when I get to Beirut.
Well, Paula Rudy, we're going to talk to you when you get there, and we're going to keep talking to you about this. We do thank you for taking this kind of stand and putting your body on the line to stand up with Palestinians who have been fighting this fight for a long time. I have this recurring dream. I had it last week. There is the great Palestinian ballerina, and she takes this great leap up into the air. It's the highest leap a ballerina has ever taken. Unfortunately, there's nowhere for her to land. There's no homeland. There's no map. There's no airport to land. So this is the battle, right?
Yeah, but we're getting there.
How do people get more information?
Well, there are lots of places. The particular organization that I work with is the Free Palestine Movement. It's www.freepalestinemovement.org. The Free Gaza Movement is another that you know very well. And, I mean,
we're going to put all this stuff up on the net, on our website at flashpoints.net. We're going to be tweeting about it for a long time. And I'm going to get Paul's card right now. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we now continue our coverage of a subject that also has some video that is very ugly, very frightening, and puts the lie, the complete lie, to the Israeli disinformation machine. Joining us is Fatima Mohammadi, who was on the Mavi Mara and has a story to tell as well. Fatima, welcome to Flashpoint. Sorry we didn't get to you yesterday, but we're really happy that we could bring you on today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Well, again, we are glad that you survived this bloody attack by the Israelis. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about where were you on this boat and what you saw.
Of course. I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
You know, it's certainly necessary when there's so much false information out there, you know, sort of propagated by the Israeli media and the PR sources that are here in the United States. I was actually on the fifth deck, on the top deck, for a majority of the time between 11 o'clock when we first started seeing the Israeli warships surrounding us. And I was on the fourth deck a little bit in the press room writing up some press releases and sending them out. But then back on the fifth deck around 3:30 when the Zodiac boats started to approach and helicopters were flying overhead and there were some drones that were flying overhead as well. The overall atmosphere on the ship, though, was fairly calm. We certainly didn't expect the type of violence that was, you know, dealt us within the next few hours. But most people were very aware of what was going on, and we were anxious. You know, we certainly had people who were watching out on all different sides of the boat to see, you know, what was happening because of the cover of darkness. But I stayed up on the top and was watching very closely and carefully to see, you know, what was happening. And when the shots began, they actually began from the Zodiac boats, the Zodiac rafts that were surrounding the boats, and they were both a combination of sound bombs and rubber bullets and pellets and I believe some sort of like a gaseous substance, like a tear gas, where I came on board. So, you know, they were firing at us as a sort of a fear tactic, but there was no conversation. There was no announcement. There was no attempt at just stopping the ship, you know, to converse in any or negotiate in any way, shape, or form. There was just the switch to intimidation and firing, and then the firing of live rounds began.
And when did the live rounds begin? Were they on the ship when they started opening with the live rounds, or were they even firing live rounds from the boats?
They were firing from the boats before they ever boarded the ship.
Okay, and then they boarded the ship.
They attempted to board the ship from by throwing hooks overboard and crawling up from the boats, which the you know, activists on board were able to just grab the hooks and throw them back into the boats so that they wouldn't board. And then they had come overhead once and tried to drop commandos and then had left again, being unsuccessful. And then they came back and then, you know, under the cover of fire, dropped the commandos on board.
So they opened fire with live ammunition to put the commandos on board.
Yes.
Were people hit by that ammunition at that point?
Yes. I believe there had already been 1 to 2 casualties by the time the commandos arrived on deck.
And then what happened?
At this point, I was on the back of the boat on the fifth deck. All of the women had gone downstairs, and I actually said my morning prayers up on the top deck in the midst of all this. And as soon as I finished, about 2 meters away from me, a cameraman from Turkey, who speaks very little English, was shot twice by 2 different guns. One was with a rubber pellet in the forearm, and then in the back of the arm with a live round. I jumped over and tourniqueted his arm, and then myself and another brother carried him downstairs. He was bleeding profusely. It took about 5 minutes to secure, you know, his bleeding and to get it to a point of being able to move him. And then we took him down onto the third deck, which was the medical deck at that point. So that from that point on, I was downstairs and wasn't an observer of what was happening on the top deck. I did go up to the fourth deck, which is where the press room was, and there were about 20 people who were sort of stuck in the press room because the commandos had surrounded that area, which is fully windowed all the way around. It was all windows around the press room, and they had sort of arrested and were holding hostage the men who were outside on the fourth deck and had them all up against the wall and were roughing them up, you know, pretty brutally right outside of the windows. And then they had other soldiers standing there with guns pointed to the people in the press room. So I moved a lot, but between the fourth, third, and second deck and wasn't able to go back up to the fifth deck. Anytime I did try to go up to the fifth deck again, you know, now it was dawn and it was light outside, you know, there was typically a soldier at the top with a gun in my face. So, you know, I slid all the way back down. The stairs were covered in blood. The bodies had been moved down from the fifth and the fourth deck down to the third deck. It was just in the lobby of the third deck, which was the medical deck again, before even entering into the sort of cabin areas where we had laid out all the injured. There were people who had died at that point, had been murdered. We had people who were in severe...
This was on the third deck where you were?
Right, on the third deck.
Describe that a little bit with some detail, please.
It was extremely gruesome. Like I said, there was blood all the way down the stairs, on the main set of stairs between the fifth, fourth, and the third deck, that I literally was sliding on as I was moving around. The volunteers had been bringing people down as they were shot at very close range. And as we now know, based on the autopsy reports, nine bodies of the Shaheed, of the martyrs, with 30 gunshot wounds. And most of the injured were similarly wounded in the sense that none of them that I saw were just shot once. They were all shot multiple times, and usually at very close range, and almost all of them with live ammunition.
Now, these were all Turkish, mostly Turkish national. Were they selected? Were these targeted killings? Were they going for a group of people? Were they sending a message to... How can you explain this?
I would say that it wasn't a targeted killing at all, and instead was, I mean, there were, I think out of the 800 or so, 700 to 800 on board, a good half of them were Turkish citizens, and then the rest of them were made up of about, 40-some, 50-some other countries. So, Moroccan, Belgian, German, a lot of British folks. I was the only American on board other than the young boy who was also shot and killed, Farkan, who was of U.S. citizenship and Turkish citizenship. He had dual citizenship, but resided in Turkey. So to me, it was a bloodbath. It was a massacre of anybody who came in the way of the commando securing the ship and being able to pirate it off of the out of international water and take it back into Israel.
And Fatima Mohammadi, what can we expect in terms of the near future? We're hearing about very specific flotillas. We're hearing about a flotilla of Jews from Germany. We have a minute left. Why don't you give us a sense of what can be expected and where people can get more information about it?
Absolutely. There are boats organizing, and they were organizing from the time that we were still in the waters and had not encountered the Israeli commandos, and shortly thereafter, people were organizing from many Middle Eastern countries. Here in Chicago, I had a meeting this morning, and they were talking about raising money and trying to send a boat from Chicago, that would be fundraised for in Chicago. So this is something that I think people are interested in getting involved.
You mean ride it right out the Great Lake and and onward to Gaza.
Inshallah. So I think that people are enthusiastic about it. I think that this is a hopeful move, and I kind of coined a phrase when I was in Kuwait and speaking about Gaza. I said that by land or by sea, by air or by prayer, we're going to get there.
By land, by sea, by air, by prayer. Oh yeah. My God. And I guess you can make reservations on all four. Well, what I want to say is I know that the audience of this show and Pacifica Radio has been watching this, and really many people have the feeling that this is in a way like the breaking of apartheid down south.
Yes.
In this country, that the Freedom Rides are now by boat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you might get a little seasick, but still, the Freedom Rides continue. Is that about fair?
Absolutely it is. Absolutely it is. It's not just fair. It's a fair assessment. It's a necessary one. I think that there needs to be a focus on what is happening, and there needs to be movement towards, ending this conflict. It is far time to end it. Right. And I think that the momentum right now is there.
All right. Well, we're just out of time. Fatima Mohammadi, a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for sharing very difficult moments with the audience. So we're all growing and learning on this one.
My pleasure. Take care.
Please be safe.
Thank you. And may I also just very quickly mention that there's new footage that's been posted online from the convoy.
Right. Well, I know. It's horrible and scary, and people should see it. Thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Just before airtime, Jesse Strauss spoke with Max Blumenthal, who has been in Israel investigating Israel's disinformation machine. Flashpoints began by asking him about how Israel seized control of the message even before the attack on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. This is what he had to say.
Israel seized control of the message in the wake of the attack. It killed a number of activists, wounded many, and arrested the rest, and stole all of their belongings in international waters, basically in an act of piracy. Stole their cell phones, stole their cameras, stole everything they'd been using to document the IDF attack and everything that happened before. Then they took about 24 hours within the IDF spokesman's office, the Israeli foreign ministry, and with coordination with the government, got their message together, selectively editing and even possibly fabricating lots of footage that they took from the flotilla boats, especially the Turkish boat, the Mavi Marmara. And then they began to blast this out into the media, blasting photographs, for example, showing supposed terrorist intentions of the passengers of the Mavi Marmara and the rest of the flotilla. Their evidence for a press release that they sent out, that the IDF sent out, claiming that there were 40 Al-Qaeda mercenaries aboard the Mavi Marmara, where that they had found night vision goggles, because, you know, everyone who can see at night through goggles is clearly a bin Laden operative.
Of course.
They laid out a kufiya next to some knives that looked, and some tools that looked like the contents of my handy neighbor's kitchen and tool shed, and claimed this was evidence of terrorist intentions and so on. And they have also released audio purporting to be of an exchange over CB radio with the Mavi Marmara, in which the captain of the Mavi Marmara supposedly tells the Israeli Navy to go back to Auschwitz, and the voice sounds like a prank call of a mentally deficient pre-adolescent. This footage, these photographs, this audio, which to me was clearly doctored, made its way into the U.S. media and was accepted at face value as gospel by American reporters like the Washington Post, Glenn Kessler, who reported that the Mavi Marmara repeatedly told the Israelis to go back to Auschwitz. And no reporters checked with the IDF for evidence of these claims. So when I got here, when I got to Israel the day after the attack, I began just simply calling the IDF spokesperson's office to ask for evidence and to investigate the veracity of all of the very loaded claims that they are making about terrorist links. And I've continued to do that up until this very moment.
And what kind of responses have you gotten? You said you've spoken with the Israeli government about these campaigns of misinformation, these doctored audio clips,
yeah,
these photographs that are supposedly from the ship.
Let's go down the line on some of the key claims that the Israeli army, the Israeli military, and the Israeli foreign ministry have been making that have made their way into the media and made a considerable impact. The first was that the Mavi Marmara, the Turkish ship, had people on board, 40 of them, who were paid by Al-Qaeda. I called the spokesperson's office along with my colleague, the Israeli Israeli reporter Leah Tarachansky, who works for the website Real News. She called in Hebrew and I called in English, and we both got the same response from the IDF spokesperson: there is no evidence. And then I noticed on the IDF's own website that they had changed the headline of their press release from 40 Al-Qaeda mercenaries found on board to 40 people found on board without identification. So they basically retracted their claim of Al-Qaeda ties. The Israeli media has not issued retractions for reporting that or issued any corrections. Then the Auschwitz clip, the notorious Auschwitz clip. I began to question on my blog whether this footage was, this audio clip was doctored. And there were some other reporters and bloggers who were raising similar questions, but I was able to actually produce the original clip that the Israelis had introduced of their exchanges with the Mavi Marmara, which was dramatically different and had nothing relating to Auschwitz or 9/11, as they claimed in the second clip. And clearly what they were trying to do was to at least get the Israeli public, if not the American public, to see this incident, this flotilla incident, in the context of the Holocaust, which is a common means of indoctrination here in Israel. They immediately issued, the IDF immediately issued a clarification after I questioned whether this clip was doctored. Clarification was that it was only part of the exchange, and the exchange that took place was between their Navy and all of the ships in the flotilla. In other words, it was on an open channel, which means that it could have been an exchange with any boat within a 100-mile radius in the Mediterranean Sea. And so they produced a third clip claiming to be the full exchange, but there's simply no way to verify whether that clip is in any way authentic at all. And it still contains the mentally deficient pre-adolescent prank caller voice. If you're listen to this clip, it's like if they remember the Jerky Boys, I mean, that's what this is. Or perhaps James O'Keefe is heading the Israeli Defense Forces press office, because that's the level of integrity that they have. And I've been tonight investigating two more claims the IDF has made, and those have fallen apart completely after I talked to their spokespeople, and they told me there is absolutely no evidence they have to support such claims.
First, could you tell us what those two claims are that you're investigating right now? But also, I believe that on your blog, you made a claim that the voice of Hoveda Araf, who we spoke with on this program last week, but the voice of Hoveda Araf in that doctored audio clip was actually a recording of her voice from a previous Freedom Flotilla experience. Is that right?
She made a claim that it could have been from a previous flotilla experience to Ma'an News, and I linked to the article. And then Hueda has sort of gone back on that and said it could have been her voice that was contained in the clip, but also related to Hueda's voice. You know, I'm only as good as my sources, and Ma'an News is only as good as its sources. And so that really, it comes down to Hueda being consistent. But regardless, the third clip that the IDF has released of their exchanges with the flotilla cannot be authenticated or verified, regardless of whether Hueda is confused about whether her voice is on it or not. And what the IDF had claimed in the second clip, the clip that I and others were able to prove was doctored, was that it was an exchange with the Mavi Marmara, the Turkish ship, but Hueda's voice showed up on it, and she was on the Challenger 1, a different ship, which contradicted the IDF story. They haven't clarified that. And the Associated Press has falsely reported that Hueda was on the Mavi Marmara. There just remains a lot of misinformation. The other two stories that I'm working on, or the other two deceptions that the IDF has put out, are first that five passengers were found aboard the Mavi Marmara with terrorist ties. And this has been reported at face value by Haaretz, a sort of left-of-center paper, a paper that's considered left-of-center in Israel and is working its way into the U.S. media. One of the passengers is Ken O'Keefe, who's a former American citizen and an ex-U.S. Marine. And the IDF claimed that O'Keefe's intention was to make it to Gaza to train Hamas commando units. It's an absolutely ludicrous claim. No, there's no way an American Marine would have any of the expertise to train commando units in Gaza. And he had been giving a lot of interviews that were extremely incriminating and contradictory of the IDF's version of events because he was involved in the melee that took place on the deck. So clearly this was a smear attempt. I spoke to Sergeant Hen Arad of the IDF press office, and he told me there's absolutely no evidence to support this claim that he can give me. The evidence comes from intelligence they have, and I asked if he could divulge any of that intelligence, and he said he simply couldn't. The second one is a photograph that the IDF has distributed, which is of a bearded Islamic man surrounded by reporters at a press, what appears to be a press conference in broad daylight, holding a knife. So it's an image that, you know, might frighten Israelis who are frightened of, Arab Muslim men with knives. It's unclear what the man is doing. The caption of the photograph in a Haaretz article entitled, Israelis tried to lynch us, commandos say. I'm sorry, passengers on the Mavi Mara tried to lynch us, commandos say. The caption by that photograph says that this man was displaying the knife after the commandos boarded the ship. And the source is the IDF press spokesman's office. So basically the IDF is saying that this scary Arab Muslim man with this shiny knife be plunging it into the gut of an Israeli soldier. There's no way to know. Of course, I mean, if you just consider the fact that it was a nighttime raid and that this picture was taken in broad daylight and that the man's surrounded by photographers and there's no context for the photograph, it's ridiculous. And so I asked about this photograph and they told me that caption and the context that they gave of the photograph being taken while the commandos were raiding the ship was taken from testimony from the commandos, which, you know, of course, there's no way to verify. And so that one sort of falls apart. I mean, if you just, if reporters here or reporters in the United States would just bother to double check what the IDF is saying, they would find that not one single word of theirs can be trusted. Their story just doesn't hold up. And this is why there has to be an international investigation, not an internal military investigation like the one Israel's about to hold with support from the Obama administration. This is a huge issue. And just another point I want to make is that in Israel, most of the reporters here are trained in the army. At their journalism training in the army, there are journalism schools, for instance, at Tel Aviv University. But the reporters you're reading from Israel have gone through the army, and they're sympathetic to the army. Some of them even are participating in the army reserves. So there's just a culture of sucking up to the army and taking their version of events at face value in this country. And while there are a few good reporters, people over in the States, like the Washington Post, Glenn Kessler, are not doing their due diligence to sort out the sequence of events. And another point is that if there were a military investigation or an internal Israeli investigation with experts, there's no guarantee that they would be working with the full unexpurgated footage stolen from passengers on board the Mavi Marmara. An international investigation would demand the full footage, and the international public would have access to that footage.
We're running out of time, so I apologize. That's the voice of Max Blumenthal. You can follow his work on his blog at maxblumenthal.com. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Max.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Jesse Strauss, with technical support from Eric Klein. Miguel Molino is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at flashpoints.net for our archive shows, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/flashpointsnews. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule to dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Thank you for listening.